Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In May of 1918, World War I was raging, and in Iowa, anti-German sentiment was making life uncomfortable for many of Iowa's German-American residents. Then things got more uncomfortable. Governor William Harding signed an executive order called the Babel Proclamation. It made English the official language of Iowa, but it went a lot farther than that. It made it illegal for Iowans to speak foreign languages in school, in church, in public, and even on the telephone. This hour, we'll talk about what led to the Babel Proclamation, how Iowans reacted, and how it changed our state. And my first guest this hour is Todd Dorman. He is a columnist and editorial page editor for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Hello, Todd.
Hello.
Thanks for being here today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So what was it that made you start thinking about the Babel Proclamation?
Well, I'd heard of it numerous times over the years, having, you know, living in Iowa, it would come up. And we got a guest column from a man named Caleb Gates, who works with refugees here in Cedar Rapids. And he noticed that it was the 100th anniversary and wrote a guest column. And so that's what prompted me to think about it. And I went back and looked at how the Gazette, and specifically the Gazette's editorial page, weighed in on the proclamation at the time.
Well, and going back in time, looking at these editorials, the Gazette, of course, covered Cedar Rapids, and Cedar Rapids is not known for being a historically German community, but a Czech community. What kinds of things did you find when you went back into the editorials?
Well, there was a lot of news coverage right at the time that the proclamation came out of people here in Cedar Rapids, Bohemians, as the newspaper called them, folks of Czech origin, Slovaks, who you know, many of whom came here to work in the meatpacking plants and other businesses. They were up in arms because the scope of the proclamation banned them from, you know, apparently banned them from speaking their native language in public. There were three Czech newspapers, I believe, at the time, and there was also a home journal, as the Gazette called it, that was printed in Swedish. So there was lots of consternation here in Cedar Rapids that the governor's proclamation would cause all sorts of folks who still spoke their native tongues from doing that. And I mean, that was the outrage. And then on the other side of the coin, or one of the other things that they were worried about, was that they didn't want to be lumped in with what the newspapers and everyone at the time called Huns, which was a derogatory term for Germans. So they were concerned not only about not being able to speak their language, but also they didn't want to be put on the same level with the Germans who America was fighting at the time.
And so a lot of the people that objected to the law may not have objected if it was just aimed at Germans.
Correct. Yeah, that's the impression I got from the coverage.
Now, I want to look at some of the articles that you uncovered, and not all of them editorials, but news articles. There's an article about the fact that everybody, or many people, want authority. And we had our producer, Ben Stanton, voice this up for us so we can listen to what it says.
It is estimated that there are more than 200 men in Cedar Rapids who are anxious to work for the suppression of pro-Germanism and disloyalty, but who feel that they should have some authority and be equipped with a star and a right to carry a gun in order to do so. As a matter of fact, it has been demonstrated scores of times that a person who is making disloyal utterances never questions the authority of any man who calls him down. Government Secret Service men who come to Cedar Rapids say that in all of their experience, when they reprimand a man who is making disloyal or unwise statements, the chap has closed up like a clam and never asked what authority the Secret Service man had for interfering. Any citizen of the United States has a right to call any person who is making disloyal utterances, and no authority is needed.
This is such an interesting article. I mean, Todd, when you read that, what was your reaction?
Well, I you know, it's a good indication of what the atmosphere was at the time. And this, you know, part of what the governor said why this proclamation was needed was that he had this worry that, you know, German saboteurs or disloyal, you know, provocateurs would use foreign language to hide their plans, to discuss what they were, you know, if they were going to sabotage something, or if they were going to, you know, do some sort of, you know, clandestine action, they would hide it behind foreign language, and not just German, but other foreign languages, which is why the governor decided to have such a broad proclamation. So I think it indicates how there was this feeling at the time that there were, you know, people infiltrating the country that were determined to do harm.
And I find it striking that whether it's true or not, that it was estimated that there were more than 200 men in Cedar Rapids who wanted to carry a gun and wear a badge to try to enforce this new law.
Yeah, I read several stories where there were instances of people basically taking, you know, citizens' action to tell someone that, you know, they should stop speaking in the way they're speaking, or they didn't like what they were talking about. There was an account I read of a couple of recruits on their way to Camp Dodge who shouted down a man in a train car. There was another instance of two workers at a restaurant that were speaking in another language, and patrons yelled at them and made them stop. So I think there was just this sort of heightened tension and anxiety, and people were determined to that, I guess, you know, if you were not speaking English, you weren't a real American.
Well, and let's play another excerpt from an article from the Gazette. This is referred to as amusing. I'm not sure amusing is the correct word, but we'll listen.
There are amusing incidents, of course. A few days ago, a woman who said her home was in Des Moines telephoned the deputy marshal and made a long and vehement complaint regarding a Cedar Rapids family, which was, quote, flaunting the picture of the Kaiser in the face of every person who called at their home. The deputy marshal went to the home mentioned and found that the portrait referred to was a picture of the housewife's grandfather, who was at one time a railroad train conductor in Germany. He was dressed in his full regalia as a conductor. The only resemblance to the Kaiser was a mustache. This family, by the way, is absolutely loyal.
So, again, that was referred to as amusing, although it's fairly chilling as well to think that neighbors were spying on neighbors and accusing them of having a picture of Kaiser Wilhelm on their wall.
Yeah, and I like how we noted at the end that they, you know, they were very loyal, so not to cause anyone to question. I mean, that's interesting that we had to throw that in at the end back in 1918. But yeah, I mean, you had people informing on each other and people watching, and it's you know, it's a very, you know, we worry about curtailments of speech and expression in any time, but that's, I mean, those are incredibly egregious examples.
And not only were people informing about photos, but there were people turning each other in for speaking a foreign language on the telephone as well. I mean, this was the day and age of party lines, right?
Right. If they heard someone speaking a foreign language on the party line, they would contact authorities. And I think I read it in articles that have been written since that I think that's the number one way people were cited for breaking the proclamation was for talking over the phone.
Were you able to see a change in how the Gazette editorialized about this or about how this was reported on over time after it was put in place?
Well, I think initially there was a lot of opposition in town. So the Gazette was against the proclamation. We editorialized that the governor didn't have the authority to issue the proclamation. I think we called it a pseudo document. And that it was an overreach and basically couldn't be enforced. We pointed out all of the institutions in Cedar Rapids that were legally chartered were foreign languages were spoken, the publications printed in foreign languages. So we were pretty strongly against it at first. And I mean, the Gazette editorial did not take the stance that that the law would be okay for Germans. It basically said that it shouldn't have been signed at all. So that was a little bit of a departure from what the public sentiment was at the time. But over time, we had maybe another editorial that also was negative. But it seemed like from the coverage I read over time, people became more convinced that these steps were needed and that there was a threat. And the editorial page didn't weigh in on the issue again.
Do you know what happened to people if they were reported for breaking this law?
I don't. I couldn't find much in the way of coverage of what actually, and at least in Cedar Rapids, what actually happened. It seemed like most of what I read was that there was this immense public pressure and that people were sort of taking these issues into their own hands and turning people in and castigating their neighbors. And I couldn't tell that whether anyone had actually been jailed or fined. There wasn't much coverage in the way of that, at least that I found. But I've read elsewhere that that did happen in some places.
What's your takeaway as a columnist who covers politics and our social climate today of going back 100 years and reading these letters?
Well, I guess the saddest thing for me is that it just seems like it's a lesson that never really gets learned. I mean, there was anti-German hysteria. We had a lot, you know, the powers that be basically pointing out scapegoats and someone to blame. In my column over the weekend, I pointed out then 24 years later, we editorialized in favor of rounding up Japanese Americans in 1942 and relocating them to internment camps. And basically it was the same argument that they were a threat somehow and that they needed to be, you know, held in camp so that they wouldn't commit sabotage or what they called fifth column action at the time. It just seems like throughout our history we found a way in times of tension and strife and war to scapegoat groups of people and to punish them, attack them, silence them. And that's, I mean, to this day, even now, we're seeing examples of that in our current situation. So that's probably the thing that stands out is that we keep doing this, we keep regretting it, but yet somehow we keep repeating it.
And did some of the language from those articles in 1918 remind you of language that you're seeing today?
Well, it's definitely reminiscent of the sort of language where you point to a group of people and blame them for danger or problems or crime or, you know, drugs. I mean, we've heard the president today use that sort of language to describe immigrants in various ways. The language is very similar to describe people who, the current government and the current people in charge point to as being the problem in this country.
Todd Dorman, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you.
Todd Dorman is a columnist and editorial page editor for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. He took a look back in the archives of the Gazette to see what the paper was writing about the Babel Proclamation when it was signed in May of 1918. We're going to continue our conversation about the Babel Proclamation, which made English the official language of Iowa, made it illegal for Iowans to speak foreign languages in schools and churches and public places and even on the telephone. Historian Tom Moraine will join us in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are marking the centennial of something called the Babel Proclamation. In May of 1918, Governor William Harding of Iowa signed an executive order. It made English the official language of Iowa and made it illegal for Iowans to speak foreign languages in schools, in churches, in public, and even over the telephone. The Babel Proclamation was repealed at the end of World War I, but it was in place for quite some time, and we're talking about what led to that, how Iowans reacted, and what the legacy is of the Babel Proclamation. With me now is Tom Moraine, former director of the State Historical Society and director of government relations at Graceland University in Lamoni. Hello, Tom.
Hello to you.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Now, Tom, on this program in the past, we've talked about the immigrant groups that came to Iowa and how they settled in the state and how things developed over time. But I do want you to take us back in time to before World War I. Let's talk about the immigrant communities that sprung up in Iowa.
Well, 19th century Iowa saw arrival of many different European groups. And with free land and ethnic migrations, a lot of communities in Iowa had a distinct ethnic population, an ethnic tint to them. Foreign languages were spoken on the street. There were many foreign language newspapers. Churches were conducted in their European languages. Iowa was not the melting pot where we all ended up looking the same. It very much was a state of communities of ethnic distinction.
And of course, as you said, we had many different pockets of these communities, and quite a few of them were German, right?
Germany was sent more immigrants to Iowa in the 19th century than any other country from Europe, and Germans often settled in ethnic communities, but they were also dispersed throughout the state, as were other immigrant groups. We weren't just pockets of ethnicity. There was mingling of ethnic groups across the state.
Before we talk about what exactly happened when the Babel Proclamation was signed, let's get to know William Harding a little bit. He was governor of Iowa at the time, and I know you've done some research about him. Tell me about the man.
I would describe Harding as probably not the brightest bulb in the marquee of Iowa governors, if we could just start with that one. He was elected three times to the legislature, and then in 2012 he was elected lieutenant governor, and then elected twice. And in 1916 he ran against a field. There were four candidates for governor. The two major issues at the time were prohibition and the Good Roads Movement, the drive to have a state highway commission that would start improving roads across the state. It would be centralized and probably promoted by assessments on property. So rural residents were often against the Good Roads Movement, and on prohibition, the Republican Party was divided between wets and dries. The wets tended to be the European immigrant groups like Germans, like Irish, that had always had some form of liquor as part of their culture. Harding represented both Republican wets and the opposition to the Good Roads Movement. So in the 1916 governor campaign, the dry Good Roads Movement was divided, and Harding won the nomination, but there was substantial opposition to him within the party. So he started out with a divided party, but one of the things he did, which was unusual, though he was Republican, he replaced many government appointees who were not Harding people. To the victor belong the spoils, and Harding and his supporters took that seriously. So he went into his term with a substantial opposition.
What do we know about the time leading up to the Babel Proclamation for Governor Harding? I mean, was this something that he spoke about? Do we have any mention of it before he signed that executive order?
I don't think there was substantial anti-immigrant feeling before World War I. As we have said, ethnic minorities were all over the state. We were a state of immigrants. In the 19th century, the state officially had promoted immigration. It distributed pamphlets all across Europe in different languages, urging people to come to Iowa. The railroads promoted immigration. There had been a major drive to get people to come and settle Iowa. So there was not an anti-immigrant feeling. But at the start of World War I, there became a passionate anti-German feeling. It was primarily directed at Germans. There are many instances. German measles were changed to Liberty measles. We didn't have sauerkraut anymore. We had Liberty cabbage. Just some language things. Everybody was trying to outdo everybody else in demonstrating their patriotism by, as you mentioned earlier, pointing the finger at Germans. And But I don't think there was a noticeable anti-immigrant flavor in Iowa prior to the war.
When Governor Harding issued the Babel Proclamation, as Todd Dorman just mentioned in the Cedar Rapids Gazette, there were some questions about the legality of signing an executive order and calling it the law of the land. Was that something that had precedent for the governor to sign an executive order like that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I can't cite any examples, but I thought the point about the extra legal pressure, that really needs to be pointed out. There were groups in every community that considered themselves the watchdogs. Maybe they weren't organized as groups, but there were people who were on the lookout for German support or people who weren't toeing the mark on their patriotism. And those people could bring substantial pressure on their neighbors to conform. There were many instances of German ethnics being confronted by a mob, and the demand was that you haven't been buying war bonds the way you should. In some extreme cases, they were forced to kiss the flag to prove their patriotism. The suspected German sympathizers might have their fence posts or their barn door or something painted yellow, and getting yellow paint was the sign that you were a German sympathizer. And that was pretty heavy social pressure. It wasn't legal pressure. You couldn't be put in jail for that unless you did some overt act. Vigilante effort against Germans was pretty powerful. What the proclamation does is to give official support to those people who say, we are Americans because we don't speak German, we don't speak foreign languages. So I think its impact tended to be more unofficial, but very powerful nevertheless.
I'm talking with Tom Moraine, former director of the State Historical Society and director of government relations at Graceland University in Lamone. I also want to bring Kelly Lau into the conversation, executive director of the German-American Heritage Center. Hello, Kelly.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And Tom was just talking about some of the things that happened both before and after the Babel Proclamation was signed, which is something that you have studied at the German-American Heritage Center. I asked Todd Dorman earlier what happened to people who were reported under the Babel Law, and you do have recorded arrests, right?
Oh, yes. There actually were about 5 Scott County farm wives that were arrested from speaking German on a party line. They were released pretty easily, but there are other associations in different cities around the country which had similar proclamations, maybe not the whole state, but there were fines up to $100, which would be about $1,500 nowadays. Some cases they threatened 6 months in jail. And there was just consequences beyond that, besides your community thinking ill of you and calling you maybe a traitor or not a patriot.
Well, and Tom had just mentioned the liberal use of yellow paint. I mean, that's something that you also have records of.
Yes, they believe that in Scott County here, we had a park, Washington Square Park, that was actually right across the street from where our museum is. And that's where Germans would often picnic and have a continental sundae. And in the center of this park was a fountain with a statue of Lady Germania atop it. And it was thought that it was doused in yellow paint to mark her yellow, and then actually it was taken down later as well.
What was the symbolism of the statue?
It was almost like a Statue of Liberty for the Midwest. So many times German immigrants coming into Iowa would arrive in New Orleans and take a steamboat upriver, landing in oftentimes Davenport, and they would see the statue, kind of outstretched arms, greeting them, a symbol of liberty and justice in this new land where they had just arrived.
And Tom, we were talking about how this affected individuals. Let's talk about churches, because as you mentioned, I mean, a lot of these different communities carried out religious services in their native languages. How did this affect religious communities in Iowa?
Those that had that continued services had continued services in their native languages. It was a real challenge. Quite often, the women, particularly the elderly women in the community, who had not had as much contact outside the home or outside their church, had not had the opportunity or the need to learn English. So quite often that ban on their native language cut them off from the only community activities they had. The ministers were put on the spot, do we continue in our language or do we not? And I think the record is fairly mixed. I'm not sure there was as much pressure to conform in the non-German languages. The Danish languages in southwest Iowa, the Norwegian languages, those weren't as much targets of the non-legal, that vigilante activity as the Germans. And as it was said, sometimes the threat caused the congregation to change to English. But there was real resistance and resentment within those churches when their patriotism was questioned and they were denied the opportunity to worship in the manner in which they had become accustomed and which they thought they were entitled to now that they were in the United States with boasted freedom of religion.
And wouldn't this law have also made it illegal to carry out a church service in, let's say, Latin?
That's an interesting question. I have not heard any Catholic churches being targeted because they use language. That's a great question, and I don't know if it was brought up at the time. Maybe the assumption was it was only living languages that counted, and nobody was thinking that there was a possibility of Roman saboteurs still toga-ing around in the state, but that's a great question. I don't know that I've ever heard that said. That mass and communion was exempted if they used wine. It was exempted from prohibition laws, but I don't know about the foreign languages.
Interesting. Well, Kelly, in thinking about the recorded arrests that we have under the Babel Proclamation, I mean, what do you know about harassment? I mean, Tom was mentioning earlier that there would be instances where, in particular, German Americans would be harassed. I mean, what do you know about that kind of environment?
Sure. Well, there's many different accounts of people just turning in their neighbors, like they have so much farmland, they should be buying more Liberty Bonds. I don't think they've bought any Liberty Bonds. Like, there were newspaper articles that had cartoons where the Uncle Sam is depicted tall and strong, and there's a German American that's depicted very short and hideous-like, and he's thumbing his nose at Uncle Sam and has, you know, a love letter to the Kaiser behind his back. This was, like, published in the newspapers here in Iowa. There was also just, the changing of the names. Anything associated with German was changed. Liberty Pups instead of Dachshunds. We also have people changing their names, so just kind of shedding their German identity.
Right, I was going to ask about that because I mean, clearly many Iowans had very, very German names. I mean, my great-grandfather's name was Detlef Nebbe, which it couldn't have been mm-hmm. more German. there were a lot of people in that situation.
Oh, yes, like Müller became Miller. The names of the banks, we had a German savings bank here in Davenport that changed its name, our Schützenpark, which was a shooting park and kind of a German amusement park in the West End, actually changed its name to Forest Park. So everywhere you looked, street names were changing, buildings were changing their name, and disassociating with the German heritage.
And how about German newspapers or foreign language newspapers? Did they just shut down?
A lot of them did. We had Der Demokrat here in Davenport, which was really widely circulated throughout the state even, and that one actually ceased publication. We did have one called the Iowa Reform, and they would actually translate everything into English and submit it, and they actually lasted till 1943, which is pretty amazing, through their efforts, but it was a much smaller newspaper with less circulation.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're marking the centennial of what was called the Babel Proclamation, when Iowa Governor William Harding signed an executive order. It made English the official language of Iowa and made it illegal for Iowans to speak foreign languages in schools and churches, in public, and even over the telephone. With me this hour, Kelly Lau, Executive Director of the German American Heritage Center in Davenport, and Tom Moraine, former Director of the State Historical Society and Director of Government Relations at Graceland University in Lamoni. You are welcome to join the conversation as well. Do you have family stories about this time? We'd love to hear them. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the 100th anniversary of the Babel Proclamation. In May of 1918, of course, World War I was raging, and Governor William Harding of Iowa signed an executive order called the Babel Proclamation that made English the official language of Iowa, but it also made it illegal for Iowans to speak foreign languages in schools and churches, in public, and even over the telephone. This affected all Iowans who spoke foreign languages, although it was definitely targeting the German Iowans of the time. With me this hour, Tom Moraine, former director of the State Historical Society and director of government relations at Graceland University in Lamoni, Kelly Lau, executive director of the German American Heritage Center in Davenport. We'd love to hear from you as well. Do you have family stories about this time? Any questions? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Kelly, we're going to get to the phones here in just a moment, but you mentioned that there were other cities around the country that had proclamations similar to this, but Iowa was the only state to have a statewide proclamation, wasn't it?
Yes, that's correct. And yeah, the anti-German sentiment definitely happened throughout the whole United States. The one recorded death that I've been able to find was actually in Collinsville, Illinois, right outside St. Louis, and a German-American was actually drugged to his death for not unpatriotic activities and kind of being portrayed as loyal to the Kaiser. So that's the most extreme example I've actually found in my research.
Did we also see things like book burnings taking place in the state?
Oh, yes. Actually, yeah, the students at Davenport High School, the day that the Babel Proclamation came into effect, all German language instructors lost their jobs that day. So many people were out of a job. The students came in, and they actually took their German books and German language books and took them out and burned those books outside the school. So many libraries pulled German titles from their shelves as well.
And I have to imagine that the consequences of something like that lasted far longer than the Babel Proclamation itself lasted.
Oh, yes. Even I think at 1915, 25% of all schools in America had German language instruction. And after the war, it was about 1%. So things never got back up to that higher percentage for quite some time.
Interesting. Let's get to the phones. John is on the line in Manchester, 866-780-9100. Hello, John.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi, Charity.
Yeah, what would you like to share?
I just, listen to your program, and I remember my my mother telling we grew up in Fontenelle, Iowa, which is in southwest Iowa. I live in northeast Iowa now, but when she was born, her maiden name was Hell, H-E-L-L, and a couple years after she was born, that's what's on her birth certificate, but the whole family changed their name to Held, H-E-L-D. And I know that it was about the same time that the Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Fontenelle had they had German services, and they had to switch to English about the same time.
Did your family ever talk about what it was like to live during that time?
They didn't. I can't remember my mother saying too much about it. I know my grandparents didn't say too much about it, but all I know is that there was pressure at that time to make the switch.
Well, John, thank you so much for calling and sharing that. And Tom, Kelly mentioned earlier many German Iowans changing their names. Is that something that was really widespread, where not just maybe Americanizing a first name, but actually legally changing last names?
I don't have statistics on it, but I'm sure that occurred. A way to display your patriotism, a way to deflect the thought that you were pro-German, was to come out with some sort of obvious sign. Let me give an example from my hometown of Jefferson. There was a clothing store owner, Julius Oppenheimer, who was very German and had a successful clothing store. He was well integrated in the community. Through the first several years of the war in Europe, before America became a participant, Julius Oppenheimer would submit letters that he was receiving from his nephews in the German army, and they were published in the Jefferson paper. And there was community sympathy because we had not entered the war. There was still a sense of neutrality, and there was sympathy for Oppenheimer for what his family was going through. As soon as the war began, Oppenheimer put American flags in his store window and made it obvious that he was a loyal American to deflect that kind of criticism. But I think that the name change would be the same type of thing. Look at me. I am giving up. I am publicly disavowing my German background. I am supporting America in the war. And I think that went on for many, many German Iowa citizens.
And Kelly, did you see that with a lot of, let's say, German business owners?
Oh, exactly. They a lot of them would change their names. They would maybe disassociate with some of the German clubs and organizations that were in town. So if you're a part of the Turner Club where they did gymnastics, you might not continue your membership there and might switch to something more neutral and not with a German background. So.
Let's get back.
Charity,
to,
let me toss. Do you have a telephone call?
We do, but Tom, what did you want to mention?
Well, what was discussed earlier about the impact on the Germans, I think we need to remember the flip side of those who are putting pressure on Germans are also displaying their patriotism. The idea of I am an American, and I can prove that because I'm not German, and look what I'm doing to demonstrate my patriotism. Discrimination has both sides of the coin, and it reinforces the sense of included in the in-group, included in the privileged group within America, which are English-speaking, which are British or oriented, and British heritage. By pointing the finger, as it was pointed out, those people demonstrated their in-group status, and I think that shouldn't be forgotten, particularly in today's climate. Those people who want to say, look at all the people who aren't American, are in the same sentence saying, I am not one of those, therefore I am truly American.
Let's go to the phones. William is on the line next in Emmitsburg. Hi, William.
Hello.
Hi, and you have a story to share.
Yes, it's one that my dad told me. And it's in Sioux Rapids on Highway 71, kind of north, going up out of this little Sioux Valley. There's a big stucco house there, old, and it's apparently, there was an old German that lived there, and there was a vigilante mob that came out to his place one night, and were harassing him and everything, and I don't know exactly what all went on, but anyway, they ended up leaving, but during that, he kept saying, I'm an American, I'm an American, I'm an American, and they left, and after they left, he went and hung himself, and so people that had been out there went out there and painted an American flag on the side of that house, and it was there in the 60s when I was a kid when my dad told me that. It was still the original flag.
Hmm.
And since then, it's been repainted, and it's like an advertisement for the Clay County Fair now. But I believe that that was left there for a kind of a... And to put as a... They, those people, I think... really felt remorse, and Storm Lake, that's south of there, is like an immigrant haven for the United States, practically. So that was my story.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, William. And of course, it's impossible to verify something like that today. But I mean, Kelly, I can imagine there are many stories like that that get handed down.
Oh, yes, there are many tales that people come in and share about the different things that their families went through. This is a little bit after the Battle Proclamation, but one of our members, her mother was born in Iowa, or her grandmother was born in Iowa and was an American citizen. And in 1917, she married a German man. And back then, a woman's citizenship was tied to her husband. So she actually was stripped of her citizenship, even though she was born here in Iowa.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Ken is on the line in Ankeny. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I was raised in Nebraska in a German-speaking community and then came to Iowa and was always confused as I heard these stories because my experience in southeast Nebraska was different. My home church had German services once a month up until 1955, and confirmation instruction was in German up until in the 40s. And then coming to Iowa and hearing about a different ethnic experience, it was always a bit confusing to me until this conversation is helpful. I happen to be a Lutheran minister, and I served in Pomeroy, Iowa, and at that time there was a Pastor Schumann who refused to give up the German language, and his church was burned, and he was jailed, and apparently there were about five or six watchdogs in the community that were kind of behind this, and so the story that was told to me, all of them died very violent deaths, so there was some sense from the part of the community, the German community, that there was some justice against these watchdogs.
Hmm.
And I also understand that in Muscatine, a strong Lutheran church there, Zion Lutheran Church, they struggled to be loyal and to prove themselves loyal, but they had a hard time, and some of that story is written in the history of that congregation. So it was quite a devastating time, to be sure, and across the river in Nebraska, it was there, but not to the extent that it happened in Iowa. So
interesting. Well, and Ken, let me ask you, since you have a up-close observation of this, what do you think the long-term effects have been of that period of time?
For the folks in Pomeroy, in the late 1970s, there was a pastor that happened to be a United Church of Christ eventually. I think originally it was Evangelical Lutheran, but he was trained was fluent in German, and he would ask some of the older families when they had funerals, would you like me to recite the 23rd Psalm in German? And they said no. Mm-hmm. It was too painful of a memory of what had been there in previous generations.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for calling. And Kelly, I want your take on that as well. You know, obviously at the German American Heritage Center, you are celebrating, really, the culture of German immigrants to Iowa. What do you think the long-term implications are for
Sure.
German Americans?
Well, basically, we talk about all this culture and all this these people who started businesses and clubs and organizations and were patrons of the arts and this huge German culture that was were in many communities in Iowa. And basically that culture was suppressed during this time. So the, you know, beer halls or different clubs and organizations, the symphony had to not play Beethoven. There's just many examples of this German culture going underground and then eventually disappearing. And even though Iowa still has a very large German heritage population, we do not see that very clearly as we once did before World War I. So we do have a permanent exhibit that talks about all this, the German immigrant experience. And we talk about how what the Germans brought to the communities and then what happened during suppression that makes it, you know, not something that is strikingly visible today throughout our communities through, with names of streets or even just cultural activities. So, you know, today there are more German cultural activities that happen, like there's Oktoberfest and different things that celebrate German culture. But the kind of 1-2 punch of World War I followed by Prohibition really knocked the culture from the sites of our community.
Well, and Tom, thinking bigger picture, what do you think the lasting implications were and are for the state of Iowa? As we mentioned earlier, Iowa was the only state to have a statewide proclamation like this one. How do you think that affected our culture?
Well, I liked what Kelly was just saying about the impact of ethnic cultures on Iowa. Perhaps not as noticeable now, but Iowa still can be very proud of the ethnic centers that we do have, including the German-American Center in Davenport. That's a great place. But we have Vesterheim in Decorah. There is the Czech Museum in Cedar Rapids. There is the Danish Museum in Elkhorn. We are proud of our ethnic heritage, but it is not as visible in daily life. I also like Todd's comments early on about the recurring tendency to find scapegoats or to point to people who may have a different background or a different faith or a different lifestyle as the source of the problems. I wish we could get away from that. And the idea that Americans are not defined by ethnicity, they are defined by our political beliefs. And I wish we could make that a more prominent factor in our political discussions.
Well, and of course, the Babel Proclamation did not last long, but Iowa does have a law on its books since 2002 declaring English the official state language, which doesn't make it illegal, of course, to teach or speak in a foreign language. But do you feel echoes of that proclamation in that, Tom?
The gene is within our body politic, I'm afraid. What I was talking about earlier, by choosing English as the official language, which of course, whether there was that law on the books or not, most people would speak English. Our laws would be published in English and so forth, is more of a symbol of a status reference to those that would want to display their privileged status.
And we're out of time, but thank you so much, Tom Moraine. This is Talk of Iowa.